Call this meeting the Ways and Means Committee to order. As I said, we're calling the vote. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's there, right? All right. First order of business is to approve the minutes from April 27th. Representative Carlson, you had a chance to take a look at those?
Yes, I'd like to move for the minutes, Chair.
Representative Carlson moves the minutes from April 27th, 2016. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The minutes are approved. First bill of up is House File 3384. I'll move House File 3384 before the committee. And Representative Hoppe, good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3384 is known as the PBR bill, the Principal-Based Reserves bill. It's a different method of evaluating, of establishing the valuation for life insurance reserves. It is, I think, a bill that has pretty wide acceptance, maybe not universal yet, but we're here as part of the process to keep working on that. I can talk a little bit more about what PBR is and why we're doing it, or if you want, we can jump into the amendment and talk about the fiscal note and the Ways and Means parts of it. So at your discretion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hoppe, why don't we move the amendment, put the bill in the shape that you prefer? Representative Davids?
Great.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the amendment.
Representative Davids moves the A3 amendment before the committee. Any discussion to the amendment? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A3 amendment? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Is approved. Your bill as amended, Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment represents, as I understand it, some minor changes that the Department of Commerce suggested, some minor changes to make this comply with the Senate language, and it also, there is a fiscal note on it. The people that are sponsoring the bill and I, what we're looking to do with the fiscal note is essentially void it or make it disappear, and we're not opposed to funding this. We want this as fully funded as the department does. Our position is that because this won't take place, none of these, if this law passes, if the NAI, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, okays the valuation model, none of this would start in Minnesota until, or anywhere in the country, until January 1st of next year. And really, we wouldn't need to start having the actuaries work on this until 2018. Next year, Mr. Chair and members, it is the intention of the industry and my intention to fully fund this and more. We want as much money as possible for the Department of Commerce. I'm generally in favor of more money for commerce in all occasions, and this was something that certainly should be funded. Our contention is that we don't need to fund it now, and it just makes it easier to get this bill passed and then worry about funding it next year in a budget year when we actually need to fund it. And the reason we want to fund it now, the companies that sell, that are headquartered here, that sell life insurance, are worried because this will become law nationally, assuming the NAIC does okay it, this will become law on January 1st, and we don't want our Minnesota domiciled companies to be at a competitive disadvantage. So you have my word, and the people in the industry, we will do everything we can to get the money in the commerce budget. I'll be 100% in favor of that next year. In the interest of full disclosure, in speaking to Mr. Brickwitty from the Commerce Department, they are not in support of this bill as it's currently written. They think that we can wait, and the commissioner shares that, just to be clear with everybody. My hope is that we pass this bill and send it to the floor, pass it from the House and the Senate with wide bipartisan support, and hopefully we can reach an accommodation with the department where they'll agree that we can fund them next year. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Members, discussion. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, yes, Representative Hoppe, you did touch on one of the issues that I know that the department is concerned about, the timing, and they were concerned that with it being done this year and would prefer to wait until next year when there would be more information on the requirements and what have you. But I did want to focus a little bit on the funding. I was listening carefully to what you said, but it does create a tail of $456,000 each year. So we're talking about roughly $1 million in tails the way you've got it structured. And I know we don't have tail targets, but we always try to watch the tails so we know what we're committing to the next biennium. And I'm not sure maybe Mr. Marks knows or could find out with other bills that have gone through what kind of tail expenses we've had to date. But this one would be significant at the biennial cost of almost $1 million. I was wondering if we could perhaps hear from the department, because I did meet with the department, and it was a concern with them about timing plus the issue of funding. And I don't know if there are certain things that they feel they have to try to do if this were to pass into law this biennium that would carry a cost. So maybe if it would be all right with you, Mr. Chairman, if they could come down and comment about their concerns at this point in time. I'm not sure who from the department. It could be the commissioner. Yeah, the commissioner is here. Mr. Rothman.
I think if the commissioner is coming down, I think we'll have Representative Hoppe respond to your question as he makes his way to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Carlson, thank you. I did neglect to mention that, and I meant to. This bill won't become law, and it's not going to become applicable unless the National Association of Insurance Commissioners changes their valuation model. And then if it does, it will become the law on January 1st for everybody in the country. The industry, the insurance industry, the company's worry is that they're going to be at a competitive disadvantage with other people that can sell here. And this won't change the fact, even if this passes, the commissioner will still be the commissioner of commerce, and he'll still be regulating insurance. And, I mean, he's still going to have the ultimate. Our goal here is not to put anybody who owns a life insurance policy at any sort of a disadvantage. The companies want to have adequate reserves to pay the policies that they need to, and they support the commissioner's, I mean, that's, you know, his job, and they're in favor of that. And they're also in favor of the funding that the department needs. The discrepancy in the, yes, the disagreement is when we need to do that. And our contention is that we'd be better off doing it in a budget year in 2017 and funding the money going forward that the department needs.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, I think the commissioner heard what my concern was with what your obligations would be this biennium relative to the cost. The bill as it now is it has a tail of $456,000 each year the next biennium. But when you and I talked, you expressed concern about the funding, and I'm assuming we were talking about concerns that you would have had for the remainder of this biennium. So maybe if you could comment on what your thoughts are relative to the funding.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee. If you could just identify yourself for the record and respond to Representative Carlson's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Carlson, as written, this bill, if passed, would require implementation in Minnesota on January 1, 2017. We'd be obligated, the department would be obligated to follow the law and to be ready to implement and to do the work necessary to implement it. We would have to start the modeling of the law 2016, this year, to do the work in modeling it, PBR, getting it ready. Right now, we're working on the national level to try to fix some of this. Our goal, my view, is that it's not prudent to implement this. We have to do it the right way and do it well, not implement this and wait until we fixed the the model law, which has got a serious problem in it right now, and we would have to spend time and resources. This is the fiscal note is $456,000. It would represent, if we had to start working on this, in essence, we'd have to find the resource to do it. It would be a cut from our perspective. We have to choose a workload between implementing this versus other things like the annuities work we do, the exams, and making sure that the companies have the appropriate amount of, say, mergers and acquisition work. We've got other companies that are interested in making sure their workload is done, and we would be put at a choice to not be able to do some of that work.
Representative Carlson.
John, Mr. Chairman, that reinforces the conversation that the Commissioner and I had the other day of his concern of what his obligations would be this biennium. And with no appropriation, then he would have to, as I understand it, and I think he just confirmed that, cut back on other requirements that the department has under law to accomplish certain things as the commissioner, and would create some difficulty at this point in time to reallocate resources without getting any resources within this bill.
Mr. Chair and Representatives,
but Commissioner Rothman,
if I might, just to put this in context, Minnesota's domestic life insurance marketplace is the eighth largest in the nation. And that's in comparison to the bottom 32. We're as large as the bottom 32 states. Right now, Minnesota and New York are the only two states with two or more companies that are equal to or greater than $100 billion in liabilities. And it represents a lot of work. Our department is already, in essence, bare to the bones. If you compare where we are as a state, the department's workload, we're already, the NAIC has done this across the country, we're already ranked the 42nd state in terms of size. And that's, so you get a big bang for the buck in terms of how much work we're doing to keep up with the complexity of this industry. And to be able, there's just really no room for us budgetarily to absorb this, which is why one of the reasons our perspective is to wait to pass this next year.
Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and to members of the committee. This is one of the most bizarre issues I've ever seen in my life. I chaired the Commerce Committee for 6 years, was term limited out. And Chair Hoppe, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. We need to do this, and we need to do this now. 43 states have already done this. 3 are pending. 2 are committed in 16, and 1's committed in 17. We are left not having passes with New York, Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and the Virgin Islands. And members of this committee, I think we can do better than that. We need to do this. We need to do this today for our domestic insurance companies. The issue of $460,000, when you want to kill something out around here, put a big fiscal note on it that makes no sense. And that's exactly what's going on here. We can use the NAIC actuaries to do the work on this thing. We don't have to move anyone from anywhere. So as far as the tails, the $460,000 per year to hire a couple actuaries, use the NAIC model. I've never seen before, and I chair the Commerce Committee. Did I mention I chaired the Commerce Committee 6 years?
Term limited out, too.
Term limited out. And some were very thankful of that. With that being said, I just don't. When you have an NAIC model, that generally means peace in the valley. We're loving each other. Everything is fine in the world. The NAIC puts some things together, and generally, as the chairman of the Commerce Committee, you just take it. The Commerce Department comes out and says, "NAIC approved. Just do it." The red herrings that are being thrown up are just amazing to me. This needs to be done. We need to get this done for our domestic carriers today. And I hope you will vote for this. There's I don't really believe for a second that the Commerce Department is bare to the bone. I've always supported the Commerce Department. I think they do great work in protecting Minnesotans, but this is beyond the pale. We have to get this done, and Chair Hoppe, thank you so much. Thank you so much for doing this.
Representative Hoppe, did you have a question or a comment?
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
I have Representative Mahoney next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I hate when I have to quit believing. But, Mr. Representative Hoppe, now you said 2018. The commissioner came up and said 2017, and then a little later said 2016. Could somebody determine when this actually has to, you have to start actually doing something on this? I don't care whether it's the commissioner or Representative Hoppe, the author of the bill. Chair Hoppe.
Go ahead. Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, right now the department is working at the national level trying to fix some of the serious problems with the actuarial work on this. So in essence, we're doing it. But here's how the bill works. It's established to have an effective date of January 1, 2017. And the way it's written in all the other states, too, is that there's a three-year implementation to be able to bring it on board. So you have 3 years as a company to choose whether you want to do PBR. If the law passes and we're required to do this by January 1, 2017, then the department would be required to start doing the work necessary to prepare to do all the modeling, look at all the modeling, and be ready for filings by the companies effectively on January 1 or January 2nd or thereafter who would want to take advantage of the
17 law. Or 16?
2017. January 1, 2017.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
Chair Hoppe, well, is that correct?
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, nobody's going to start selling these policies until January 1st, 2017, assuming that the NAIC fixes the valuation model. If they don't fix that, this law doesn't go into effect anywhere in the country. If it does and we don't pass it this year, Minnesota companies will be at a disadvantage. If it passes and we get it fixed and it starts on January 1st, this does not apply to any existing policies. This is only policies going forward. Not every Minnesota company is going to be doing this to start. So we're not going to have a ton of policies. There's not going to be a lot to review in 2017.
Representative Mahoney.
You know, St. Paul has a couple of insurance companies in it, located in it, just one or two. So it's something I follow a little bit. And I've heard no opposition from these insurance companies to paying the cost of putting this together. Whether you do it today, tomorrow, 2017, 2018, they didn't say it outright, but they were kind of concerned that they didn't get gouged, which I get. So I don't know why you didn't put that in the bill. I mean, that seems to be the only concern the Commerce has, and you won't put it in the bill. There may be other concerns, but they've got people that they can focus on this, because we've seen what happens when, because everyone on this committee has been a chair at some time, and we've cajoled, or most everybody on this committee has been a chair at one time. We've cajoled the department heads or whomever when they come into our office and they say, well, I can't really do this, I don't have the money, to kind of figure out a way to get them to agree to absorb it into their budget, which just means somebody at their office goes from working 42 or 44 hours a week to 45 or 46 or 48 hours a week with no difference in wages. Basically, we just are saying, okay, these are our public employees, let's make them work harder. You've got an industry that says, we're okay with this. You got a commission that says this will make it much better. He does not seem to be that thrilled either one way or the other. But if you go halfway, you're there. You settle a lot of people down. And, you know, the commissioner has indicated that we're 42nd as a Commerce Division in terms of employee to regulatory. Our employees are 42nd on the list compared to other states, so we're fairly efficient. Apparently, a six-year term is enough to keep efficiency going, although I've known other chairs that have made that claim, too. So could you tell me why you're not putting this in now? If you could, if the insurance companies have not seen it fit to come into my office and say, don't charge me, because nobody else that comes up to this particular building has a problem saying, don't make me pay for it, make somebody else pay for it. And they never said that. And that seems to be a big part of this. Why haven't you put that in there?
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney and members, I'm not opposed to giving money to the Department of Commerce. I said that earlier. I don't think we need to do it now. Let's do it next year during a budget year. The department doesn't need the money to do this right now. What I do know is that if we don't do this, the Minnesota insurance companies that are domiciled in Minnesota that are going to sell life insurance consider that they will be at a considerable disadvantage to their competitors.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mahoney.
But you can't pass a bill, you can't pass a law, you can't require a department to say, to do something and say, get ready for it, but by the way, you don't need to do anything, you don't need to spend any money to do it. You're saying a year from now we'll give you some money. It take them 2 months or 6 months to hire an actuary because they're not standing on the corner making jokes because they don't have a sense of humor, as a past chair used to tell me. So you're going to need to get those people in place. They need it now, not a year from now. And now I'm done.
Representative Poppy, to that point. Representative Davids, to this point.
Well, yes, I'm a little confused here about the cost when the NAIC would pick up the cost to do the work. And then we have, in the fiscal note, actuaries making what the original note had, $265,000 a person. That's a lot more than the governor makes. Not as much as I make, but more than the governor makes. They're asking for $220,000. Do we pay actuaries in the Department of Commerce $228,000? Can we even do that? I thought you couldn't pay state employees more than the governor. That's one thought. And as far as an actuary is actually a CPA without a personality, is kind of how that works. But aren't we able to use the NAIC actuaries to cover the costs? I don't see where all the costs are. Chairman Hoppe? Or Mr. Chairman?
Commissioner Rothman or Representative Hoppe?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that question. Go ahead. The fiscal note that you have explains that this is the full cost of employment for two actuaries. Under the statutes in Minnesota, there's an exemption for the salary cap for actuaries because you would not be able to hire, the state would not be able to hire actuaries at the salary cap level. So there's a specific statutory exemption for the hiring of for actuaries. And what it represents is not only just salary, but the full cost of employment. It's the average amount for an actuary that we've estimated for two of them. And the costs include the benefits and everything that goes with the complement for, as all other employees are allocated the costs. So it's pretty straightforward. And if I might, there's two or three things that I want to be clear on the record from the department's perspective that have been said about our perspective, which are simply not true. I want to be clear about a few things on some of the merits of this bill. First of all, we would need the funding to be able to do it. There are not enough actuaries at the NAIC to do this. Those are devoted to the smaller states, not the larger states. As I indicated, Minnesota is one of the top eight and the largest. Second of all, if this law goes into effect on January 1, 2017, regardless of whether it's fixed or broken, it is the law of Minnesota. So with all due respect, if the manual, which is driving the problem here right now, is broken, we're going to have, nationally, it's projected, a huge drop in reserves in the term life insurance industry from term life insurance on 10-year and 20-year insurance. This has been testified to by New York Life Insurance Company. We provided the documentation for that to the company. So let me, to the legislature. Let me explain why. And as insurance agents and folks that buy and sell insurance, this is what it means in practical terms. The actuaries that have calculated the manual have determined that that the reserves on the life insurance industry nationwide will drop too low. They'll drop 60 to 100% too low. In fact, almost 100% in some instances. What does that mean? It means that within 5 years, we will have insufficient reserves across the country of tens of billions of dollars and calculated out to, in 10 years from now, to more than $100 billion of a reserve gap. What does that mean to Minnesota consumers? It means that when a non-domestic company sells into Minnesota, you purchase a term life insurance policy, it's not going to have the sufficient reserves in place to pay claims over time for our Minnesota consumers. There's a solvency risk that we're working on and trying to get this fixed. The way I look at it is that our priority is to make sure that we have the solvency of the companies in place, we understand the competitive advantage, but we also are very concerned to make sure that the companies across the United States have a competitive playing field where they're all playing with the same level. To put it in a nutshell, this is how I would analogize this. It's like the auto industry or auto company having standards for your brakes across the country that are broken. And before you put those cars onto the streets as broken, they should be fixed. And that's the position of the department. We are working at the national level at the NEIC to have the manual fixed so that it's not broken. Our proposal, Minnesota's proposal, is being debated, but it won't. But our concern is it won't be passed in time for this legislative session. And so, first of all, the manual has to get fixed before this becomes law. Otherwise, we're all going to be suffering for. I would also liken this to the fact that just like the long-term care industry was under-reserved and created serious problems, this is a similar issue. So we have the gap, the reserving problem. We have to make sure we have a clean version, and we want to have the resources in place to do this. That's what's really happening, and that's why we want to make sure we do this right, do it well, and do the prudent thing, and just wait a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it's amazing to me how doing the prudent thing is being right up there with Puerto Rico, Guam, American Samoa, and the Virgin Islands. But you're saying that there's all these costs. For a question for Commissioner Rothman, how much did Iowa charge? How much did the state of Iowa give to Iowa to implement this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, I do know the answer. The answer is zero. They did it for zero. And your comment about how this is just for the small states, the NAC actuaries, that's not correct. Any state can use the NAC actuaries for this. So the red herring, there's so many red herring, and now all of a sudden we're all going to be insolvent. Commissioner, you have a great department. And you regulate insurance companies in Minnesota. You don't regulate the ones in New York or Texas or all the states that have seen the wisdom to do this. We are hanging out. This is an embarrassment. This is an embarrassment to the state of Minnesota to do this to our domestic companies. 80,000 clean, high-paying jobs, and we're putting our companies at risk. The Department of Commerce testified in committee that there's no problem with the solvency. We're not worried about solvency here. And you said 100% of the reserves could be gone. So, members, just vote for this. Get it out of here. Get us off the list with Guam, American Samoa, Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. Please.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, if the legislature has the wisdom or believes to or finds the money to fund the positions that you have in this fiscal note, will you remove your opposition to the bill?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Garofalo, there are three issues outstanding. One is that the valuation manual needs to be fixed at the national level. With all due respect, that has to be done. Otherwise, the reserves across the country will drop and Minnesota's consumers could be harmed or would be harmed. Second of all, we need a clean version of the bill It has to be really just a practical copy of the NEIC's model, and we would be happy to work with everybody to get it to the clean version. And third, we need the staffing for it at the department.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, again, I'll ask the question. If we do fund this position, will you drop your opposition to the bill?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, our opposition is predicated on those three things, and until they're solved, we oppose the bill. And we would, our position is it's more prudent to wait until 2017 to pass it.
Chair Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, just to be clear then, so if, as part of the Supplemental Conference Committee, if we were to fund the positions in this with no other changes, you would still remain opposed to this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, I believe the effective date needs to be contingent on fixing the evaluation manual. And a clean version of the model.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, by the way, for my good friend Chair Davids, he said twice, to quote him, did I mention that I was chair of the Commerce Committee for 6 years? I neglected to mention that I served on the Financial Institutions and Insurance Committee years ago. That was a predecessor to Commerce. I just thought I would put that on the table for my good friend. But then seeing Representative Erdahl, he asked me one time in committee, he said, is there any committee you haven't served on at one time or other? And I thought, you know, it's an interesting question. There were some that I hadn't. But anyway, that's not where I was really headed. I just wanted to respond to Representative David Stokes' comment, being that he spoke after I did. The question that I was trying to raise, and I know there are other issues on the table, but the question I was raising was to make sure that if this moved forward, we were giving the department the adequate resources because of the timing of the implementation. And I know there are other issues that the commissioner has brought forward. But I really think if a bill like this is to move forward, and if the other policy debates take place on the floor of the House or in conference committee, there has to be a discussion at least of making sure that you give the department the resources necessary to prepare for the change, and that puts it in this biennium. That was the question that I was trying to raise, not necessarily trying to block the bill or whatever was being implied by earlier comments. What I was trying to do was just make sure resources are available there. And I did raise the question of tails. That is $1 million in tails that when we pass this bill, and I represent, and Representative Hoppe said he would make a commitment to make sure that it is funded next biennium. But quite frankly, one legislature can't bind another. I mean, that's a verbal commitment, and I'm sure that he means that. But it doesn't happen until it happens, quite frankly. And I think talking about resources, whether they're in the tails or this biennium, is an appropriate discussion in this particular committee, because that is our main role, even though we do at times get involved with some policy. But our main role is to talk about the resources.
Chair Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To Commissioner Rothman, 48 states have seen the light to already pass this, don't seem to have the concerns that you do. And so what happens if Shifting Sands Mutual Life Insurance Company from Iowa sells a policy into Minnesota? Are Minnesotans at risk? They've signed up for this, but Minnesota has not.
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, first of all, I would be remiss not to share with the committee and you that not all of the states that have looked at this, including or have already passed it, including some like California, Florida has passed it. We're talking about Alabama. The committee of the actuaries that are looking at this serious gap, which is called LADIF, and I know you're familiar with it, being at the NEIC. Those actuaries from those states that have passed this law already are quite concerned themselves that if because they passed the law and the manual isn't fixed, it would be effective in their state as broken. And they're working together with us to try to fix it. The other point is that to your company, my concern is that if we don't fix the manual to make sure that their reserves aren't in place to pay the claims of our Minnesota our Minnesota consumers, your policyholders, your customers, that when it comes time to pay up, that those reserves aren't going to be there and sufficient to pay the claims.
Well, Mr.
Or
Chairman,
maybe I missed the question. I
forgot what the question was.
Sure, David.
But Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Rothman, you mentioned that some states didn't like what was going on here. Are any states considering getting out of this?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the states right now that have passed it have passed the law. Those that have passed the law are looking at LATIF to make sure that the manual gets fixed. What's happening, the dynamic is this, is that the insurance industry has been opposed to fixing the manual nationally, other than New York Life and some others. And so this little debate we're having here is a national debate at the NAIC to try to resolve the reserving requirements. Over time, hopefully, we'll try to resolve it.
Well, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bottom line, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bottom line on this is that our companies are being hurt unless we pass the HOPI bill. It's just that simple. And so I hope we can move on to the next bill because I think it's mine. I want to talk about something less controversial like MNsure.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Final word, Chair.
Representative. You know, we have talked to the companies in Minnesota. We're not in disagreement. Minnesota companies are good companies. As I indicated, we're the eighth largest domestic insurance life industry in the country. We work with them all the time. And we've analyzed whether or not they would be put at a competitive disadvantage. And there's really only one, maybe some others. They can testify themselves as to when they might take advantage of this. But again, there's the three-year implementation pathway. And we're saying that the priority of making sure that the reserves are in place, that there's financial backing for all of this, is from the department's perspective, consumer perspective, in the balance of things, a little bit more important than the competitive disadvantage of the companies, which I've also said this in the Senate committee, Representative Davids. If this law doesn't pass, I'm willing to have conversations with them to accommodate them so that they won't be in such a position.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make Representative Davids aware that I can use my cell phone and get on the internet and find out that actuaries make starting at $150,000 up to early stage $250,000. So not having a personality does not preclude you from making a fairly decent living.
Is that per month?
Well, that's you, Greg.
Final word to your bill, Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you very much. I think a couple of things. One, we all want to make sure Minnesota consumers are protected. This is not going to be dangerous for our reserves. This is only for policies sold after January 1st, 2017. For those watching at home, don't worry. Your policies are safe. With that, we still have some disagreement on this. But I think at the end of the day, we all want what's best. I'd appreciate your support, and we'll see what we can do with this moving forward. Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your time.
Representative Murphy, I apologize. You were on the list, and I overlooked your name. So you do have the final word.
Well, Mr. Chair, I really didn't want exactly the final word, but I have a couple questions. And the discussion has brought kind of a sense of an urgency to this, but Commissioner is talking about a three-year pathway. So if there's a three-year pathway into it starting in 2017 or 2018, I don't see how that could have a sense of urgency. But from the discussion, I've also heard that many states have already jumped on board and said this is good, and just Guam and the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico, they're fantastic places. That those places haven't yet jumped on board. So, but the House file number is 3384. So that means it's introduced this year, not last year. And if there was an urgency, it should have been introduced. It seems to me it should have been introduced during the appropriations year in 2015 to get it going. And we're not there. And then I have one more question. But could you respond to those two things that I brought out?
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy and members, the insurance companies started working on this in January that I know of. It could have been before that. But January of this year, I introduced it this year. That's when it was brought to me and asked me if I would carry it. If it would have been last year, I certainly would have been happy to do so. And next year, assuming I get back here, whether we're in the majority or the minority, I will advocate for putting this money in the budget for the Department of Commerce.
Okay. And
Representative Murphy.
And so, Representative Hoppe, do you feel that there's an urgency?
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, and members, I do, because that's what I hear from the companies, the Minnesota companies. They're concerned that if they're not able to sell in Minnesota on January 1st, some of their competitors from other states might be able to come in here and sell, you know, with the new method of valuation.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, then, how many companies are we talking about, and how many possible policies could be sold by these many companies that otherwise will be at competitive disadvantage?
Representative Hoppe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, and members, I don't know exactly. There are likely to be two or three or maybe four Minnesota companies that initially start this outside of Minnesota. I don't know. My suspicion is that this would be, and I'm not in the insurance industry, but my suspicion is there would be a ramp-up period as the people that are out there selling this get more familiar with the product and sell more life insurance. Somebody, I can try to get you a best guess on how many policies would be sold, but my guess is especially at the start of 2017, it wouldn't be a huge amount.
Mr. Chair, could I ask Commissioner to, do you have the same numbers in mind? Because you said that Minnesota is the eighth largest in the nation, right?
Yep.
And so by eighth in the nation, are we talking three or four companies, or are we talking 50 companies?
Well, Mr. Rothman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, it's currently the market share on the life Minnesota insurers hold over $270 billion in future claims requiring reserves in Minnesota. The biggest companies are those like Allianz Life Insurance Company. Securian is another major company. We're not talking, you know, we're talking a small number of very large companies that are global in size. And then in terms of two other comments. In terms of, it's our understanding that Minnesota domestics, other than maybe one and some others, are not ramping up immediately to jump in the market on January 2017. They're happy to say what they would like to say, but a lot of companies across the country are waiting and chomping at the bit to come here and market with their reserves dropped, obviously. And there's a bit of an inconsistency here, because if our companies want the department to be ready on the urgency to do this on January 1, 2017, but also saying, no, we don't need the resources at the department to do that until later in 2017, that this doesn't work for us, because we will have to be ready to do it if we pass the law if we have to be ready to do it, one way or the other.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and Mr. Chair. And Representative Hoppe, is there a reason you didn't just write in the bill that the entities that want to have this process pay for the cost of commerce? Commerce has the ability to charge fees for the cost of their items. Why don't you just give them the authority to actually charge the fee to fund the program that the people are just chomping at the bit to get?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hillstrom, there's no reason, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it after this, and I'd talk to it with the companies. But other than that, I haven't thought of it yet.
Representative Hailstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hoppe, we spoke about an amendment, and I'm sorry, I came late. Was that adopted?
You voted yes.
And Representative Hoppe, does that have a safety valve for the commissioner to say if he has concerns with the book that's not fixed, that he can prohibit or keep this from being implemented?
Representative Hoppe.
I don't know that it specifically has a safety valve for the commissioner, and that's something, again, that I can talk to you about after this committee. I don't work for the insurance industry, but as the author of the bill, I mean, the industry, the Minnesota companies want this to work. They want it to be safe for Minnesota citizens and for their consumers. And they, you know, the Department of Commerce is what regulates the insurance companies, and they want to work with the department to make sure that they're covered and their customers are covered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hailstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is for the commissioner. Commissioner, if Representative Hoppe gives you the safety valve that it doesn't, that you have the ability to stop it from going into effect if the book is not fixed, and he gives you the authority to charge fees to cover your cost to the industry that you would be regulating, does that take care of your concerns?
Commissioner Rothman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hailstrom, there were three concerns that would take care of primarily the two. One being to make sure that this law does not become effective until the valuation manual is fixed. Second is to have the appropriate resources. And third, that we have a clean version of the legislation. This amendment gets us there. It's still not close. It's not quite there. But with it, those three things, those are the reasons why we're opposing the or asking the legislature to wait until next year to do this.
Any further discussion? Any further? Hearing none, I will renew my motion. Refer House File 3384 as amended to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is approved. Next on the agenda is House File 2970. Representative Vogel. While you're making your way down, Representative Vogel, I'll move House File 2970 before the committee. I understand you have a technical amendment to your bill.
I do, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Would you
also brought some treats, but unfortunately, I'm not sure if my math was good for this big a group, so please don't hold me in burden if I'm in a deficit position already.
To your bill, Representative Vogel.
Mr. Chair, on line 2.10, there's been quite a bit of discussion with MMB on how this bill might function in the marketplace. And to clear that up relative to the first engrossment, if in line 2.10, we could just eliminate the words and issue. So it would then read, the debt limit is in this subdivision may only be used to limit authorization of new debt.
Mr. Sullivan, do you want to just respond for the benefit of the committee members what Representative Vogel's technical amendment verbal would be?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the amendment would modify page 2, line 10 of the House File 2970 first engrossment by deleting the words and issuance.
Discussion to the oral amendment. Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the oral amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committees. Members?
To your bill now as amended, Representative Vogel.
Thank you. HF 2970 sets a 3.5% cap for bond payments paid out of the non-dedicated general fund revenue. In doing so, it puts in place a cap beyond the guidelines which are now being used by MMB. Whereas the current guidelines deal with how much in bonds can be outstanding, this cap looks at how much of the general fund will be needed to make the payments. Helpful analogy would be to relate it to the intent of a home mortgage. When someone decides to buy a home, they are typically told how much they qualify for, which then becomes the amount of outstanding debt they are told they can handle relative to their down payment and other factors. In addition to that, however, the person looking to get the mortgage also needs to know how much of their income they are responsible and willing to spend on the payment relative to their future plans and financial well-being, which is the debt service ratio. We as a state currently are doing a qualify for amount using the MMB guideline. But in 2009, the how much we can afford of our income, general fund revenue, was removed, so we no longer look at that guideline. HF 2970 puts that affordability measure back into practice by capping the amount that can be used for all debt payments paid out of the undedicated general fund revenues in any period to no more than 3.5% of forecast general fund revenue for that period. The cap is applied to all obligations for which the payments are made from the general fund and looks to all periods in the revenue forecast. Prior to 2009, the debt service measurement was used as one of the three initial guidelines which had been in place since 1979, one of them being a debt service guideline and the other two dealing with the total amount of outstanding debt. When they were originally adopted by Governor Quay administration in 1979, the debt service guideline was 2.5%. Over the years, there were some adjustments, and by the mid-1980s, the debt service guideline settled at 3%. Over the years, two more guidelines were added, another dealing with total debt outstanding and one to limit maturities. From that point on, the 3% did not change, but there were varying interpretations which helped to circumvent the 3% in some cases. The most recent example of exceptions was the use of appropriation bonds in 2008, which seems to have been one of the reasons to remove the debt service guideline, because there was conversation as to whether they were a long-term legal obligation of the state or not, part of that definition that goes back to 1979. This, as well as other examples, added to the subjectivity of the measure debate that had occurred over the years and eventually led to dropping the debt service guideline. Because of this evolution over the years and often the lack of definition as to what was included in the debt service ratio calculation, the new guidelines dropped the debt service guideline. So starting in 2010, the new guidelines no longer use the payment to revenue guideline because it was decided it no longer was needed to manage the amount of debt being accumulated. It's important to note, however, when that happened, there was no longer a look-forward measurement because all the others were static point-in-time measures. And with the debt service guideline eliminated, it was the only one that looked forward to the payment needs from the general fund. As a result, it removed an important source of information so conclusions could be made about both present and future uses of revenue available for debt payments relative to other needs the state's non-dedicated fund needs to fund, such as HHS, education, transportation, and so forth. Going back to 2008, when the historic guidelines were still fully in place and being utilized, the annual debt service using all payments from the general fund was $409,296,000 and represented 2.45% of general fund revenues. In 2015, the payments had increased to $752,121,000 and were 3.67% of revenue. So the increase in dollars needed for payments from 2008 to 2015 has been $342,825,000 each year, which is a percentage increase of 83.7%, and also reflects a significant increase of 49.7% in the percent of revenue now needed to service the debt from the undedicated general fund revenues. It also includes an increase of $130,485,000 of debt outside the GO debt, things like appropriations bonds, which had payments of slightly less than $18 million in 2008, that have added considerably to the amount of debt service and are now one of the reasons the bill uses or the bill uses the all non-dedicated revenue as the payment determinant. To more carefully manage the state debt, I drafted House File 2970, which states clearly that debt payable from non-dedicated state general fund revenues is what is to be included in the calculation of the debt limit ratio and is not to exceed 3.5%. It also provides a look forward, since it states the ratio needs to be determined for all years of the forecast. The rationale for the cap is to both give the legislature information it needs to provide good financial management dealing with the availability and use of non-dedicated revenues for all areas of state government, as well as setting a cap so both the public and those purchasing the debt see the legislature as manage the debt in a sound manner. The cap does not disallow borrowing this year if that is the choice of the legislature, and is not intended to be a statement on whether or not bonding is good or bad. Rather, it's a way for the legislature to determine how much debt is prudent for both now and in the future, so the payments on the debt do not overburden either today's or tomorrow's taxpayers with obligations they find difficult to fund. Mr. Chair, that's my comments. I'm sure it might prompt some questions. Mr. Lee is also here with some charts that he can, I think he has been included in your packets, that he can explain how he derived them, if you would like.
Members, questions? I believe that Budget Director Kelly has some questions, comments that she'd like to make. Before, while she's making her way down, Representative Wagenius, did you have a question?
Well, I'll start.
Representative Wagenius, if you could just turn the mic towards you, thank you.
Well, she's coming down. I mean, we are removing the state's flexibility, and I understand Representative Vogel's wanting to manage state debt. I mean, that's what he said, and to be able to look forward. And I get that. However, when you only look at what money we're going to use for bonding, we're looking in a silo. So we have another debt, and that is all the asset preservation that we're supposed to do. And if we can't pay for that because we put a cap, because we're managing state debt this way, then we are expanding state debt another way. So I just, in order maybe to explain that a little bit better, I had staff list the state obligations for asset preservation for this year.
And you could have the pages help pass those out.
So what this is, members, is the total agency requests for this year, and it's $407 million. So that would be two-thirds of the bonding bill that you proposed. And maybe that is what your choice is going to be for this year, just to pay for this and have $200 million for something else. But what I think it happens in the future, if we put a cap on and say we're managing for state debt this way, then we are ballooning another piece of state debt, which is asset preservation, if we're not paying it all down each year. And I this committee has not had a broad discussion of that. I know Representative Torkelson is aware that the asset management in DNR is well beyond what is they've asked for this year. It's huge. And I suspect that's true in other jurisdictions, too. I don't know that. I just know the DNR one. So it's kind of like a balloon. You push it in one way, and it pops out another. And I think we have to be very careful not to increase another debt because we are trying to say we're going to do good management. I don't think it's happening. We're only looking at a little piece, a silo. So that was my notion, and I think that's a bigger issue that we need to discuss as ways and means. What are we going to do about this asset management iceberg that we have?
Representative Vogel, your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I guess could you just kind of restate the question a little more? Specifically, I wasn't sure exactly what you're asking relative to the bill.
I'm not actually asking anything. I'm making an observation.
Oh, okay.
And the observation is if we put a cap on to say we're managing state debt and looking forward, we also have to look at our obligations in asset preservation looking forward. And we as the committee have not really discussed that big iceberg. It's huge. What I put down here in this sheet is only for this year what agencies ask for. I know DNR is substantially more than what they ask for this year. It's an iceberg. And so I don't want us to ignore the iceberg and thinking we're doing good management by putting a cap in one spot because it doesn't work.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. What stunned me here was the increase. We're now spending almost $350 million a year more than we were back in 2008 before the cap went off, which almost is enough to fund this. And that's a year, so it's a, you know, almost $700 million a biennium that's going out now more in payments. And my concern is that we're going to dig ourselves such a hole with adding debt that we will start to restrict, as we already are, the amount that we have left in the general fund to do other things, which some of this could actually have been done in cash. Now, I wasn't here, and I'm not saying whether or not I would have voted for this stuff, and I'm not criticizing anybody for having done it. But you just look at the numbers and you start looking at $700 million a biennium more since 2008 in debt payments and what that could do. So that was one of the things that piqued my interest with this is, yes, it will be difficult, but it's also difficult when you paint future legislatures into a box of not being able to fund this because we're taking too much out of the general fund. And that's the reason for the bill, is to look at how much of the general fund do we prudently think that we can take each year? Because it's done. When we get here, when we got here this biennium, there was $1.5 billion spent before we even started in payments. And that's the intent of the bill, is to get a handle on that and to make sure that we're having those tough discussions before we take on the debt rather than having to deal with it later.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Vogel, for bringing this issue forward. It's been very enlightening to the study and the work you've done to enlighten my committee has been very valuable, and I appreciate your work. Thank you very much. Representative McGinnis has passed out this sheet relating to asset preservation, and it sounds to me like she's advocating that the only way to preserve our assets is to borrow more money. That's really like taking out a second mortgage on your house, which in some cases may be appropriate, but for a lot of folks, taking out that second mortgage is what got them in a lot of trouble. It's not always a good idea. Taking care of the things that we already own is critical. I agree with that. I think Representative Pagenius, I agree that that is very important. But to insinuate that the only way
that we can take care of our assets is by borrowing more money to do that. I don't know that that's necessarily an appropriate argument. So, in fact, just briefly looking through the Senate's bonding proposal for this year, it looks to me like they're funding about half of the requests that are there, even though that bonding bill is well north of $1 billion.
Representative Arguinius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry if you thought I was implying that we should do asset preservation by debt only. I don't. But you've got to either do it by debt or cash, one or the other, or you are digging a hole of debt, only it's a different hole of debt, and that is not paying off and not taking care of your assets and getting a bigger and bigger, which has happened in DNR since we haven't, both administrations haven't done what needed to be done, and we have an iceberg there, and I suspect there are icebergs in other places too.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you for that, Representative Guinness. I'm glad you don't advocate only borrowing to do this work. And you're right. We have dug a hole. And every time we build a new building, every time we build a new bridge, every time we build another mile of road, every time we construct another new trail, we are adding to that potential for maintenance down the road. And you and I agree that we have not done a good job of accommodating that responsibility. At the same time, Representative Vogel's pointing out another problem, and that our continued appetite for borrowing has created a huge debt service load to our general fund, which restricts our ability to do that asset preservation work that you're talking about.
Representative Arguinius.
Or we could do it with cash this year, because we do have the cash and we could do that this year. I don't weigh in one side or the other. It's just that it's got to be done. Otherwise, we're digging another hole. And to say that there's only one hole out there is wrong. There are two.
Welcome to the committee, Director Kelly. If you could just name, give your name for the committee and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, my name is Margaret Kelly. I'm State Budget Director with Minnesota Management and Budget. And first off, I think it's great that you're having this conversation here amongst yourselves. And secondly, I appreciate the one amendment, the technical amendment, oral amendment that was offered, that it still puts the burden of responsibility for authorizing the debt on the legislature and not on MMB in terms of issuance. There are still a few small technical issues in terms of timing and effective dates that I think I'd like to talk with the author about. But overall, I want to say that MMB is in the position that a debt management guideline of this sort should be in policy and not in law, and that our experience in the past is a good example of why. Experience in other states is also a good example of why, in that the legislature has always, and the administration, the governor, has always wanted some level of flexibility that putting it in law does not allow, that we may at times be out of compliance without the intent to be out of compliance and no way to address that. There will always be pressures and an expectation on NMB to find a workaround. And what rating agencies look to is that we have guidelines that we manage to. And it is not more valuable to them that it be in law versus it be in guideline, but what's important to them is that we have something that we're trying to manage to. And putting in law limits our flexibility and makes it harder for us to manage to it. And so we're not supportive of language that would put a limit in law.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just to pick up on what Ms. Kelly was pointing out, and that was actually, I had that on my list here as to why not policy instead of law. I was part of discussions a few years ago when Pawlenty was governor, and I was on capital investment, and then we also had discussions. I think at that point I was chairing the Finance Committee about changing the guidelines. And in the end, I think Governor Pawlenty requested MMB to take a good look at that and to change the guidelines. That approach, as is just pointed out, provides for flexibility. I mean, if you have a major disaster of some sort, or if you have a shift in the economy, when you have a policy, you have some flexibility. And when we put it in law, that's going to be very restrictive. And so my question then would be of Representative Vogel, or perhaps the chair of the Capital Investment Committee, as to why not doing what we did a few years ago with good cooperation with Governor Pawlenty, taking a good look at the policy if you feel there should be changes, and do it that way as opposed to putting it in statute. So if either one, maybe I'll ask Representative Vogel directly, and then if the chair of Capital Investment wants to chime in, I would appreciate hearing from him as well as to why not policy.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. The concern I have is that we had it at 3%. We took it away, and now it won't work for any less than 3.5%. And if it's in law, I agree that it is certainly more of a caveat. It's law. But I think it also then disciplines us as a legislature to look at this and say, where can we go? And I think it's also important to remember, this is not a go-to number. This is a go-up-to number. And just because we could borrow, just because we could borrow that much doesn't mean that we prudently should borrow. And yes, there are emergency situations that can arise, but to look at managing this long term, you know, the suggestion of a financial person would be, you don't borrow up to your absolute limit, because then you are handcuffed. So if we look at this long term, we start bringing that number down, and if there is an emergency, you have a little flexibility. But when you start deviating, we've already deviated and I think taken on quite a bit of a debt responsibility here. When you start deviating, you kind of set yourself up to more deviation. And that's why I think it's important that we look at this as an absolute and say we're not going past that, because we just don't think it's prudent as a legislature to do that. So that was the intent of putting it into statute, is to kind of stop what's become a little bit of a runaway train. No pun intended.
I would, Mr. Chair, if I could hear from Representative Torkelson, if he has any thoughts that he'd be willing to share.
Chair Torkelson.
As law versus policy.
That.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. You know, there's no doubt that, in my mind anyway, that our current guidelines don't seem to be working very well. And our current guideline says that we could borrow up to $3.2 billion for bonding without feeling any pain to our budget. It just doesn't seem appropriate. To reevaluate our current guidelines is certainly important. Representative Vogel has brought this issue forward. The question of whether it be in statute or guidelines is a good one. I think this is important enough and a critical enough situation that putting in statute is absolutely appropriate.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think then, at least with some of us here, we have a fundamental disagreement on that, because I come down on the side of flexibility. Just because you could bless whatever that number was doesn't mean that you do or would. The fact of the matter is, when I was on capital investment and when I would be working on the targets with finance and ways and means, we paid very close attention to those guidelines when we were setting the targets for the debt service. And when it was 3%, we watched that very closely. I'm hard-pressed to think if we ever went over that. If we did, it must have been pretty rarely, or there must have been something unique driving it. Ms. Kelly may know if we ever went over the 3%, but we did reach the point where, as I was mentioning earlier, Governor Pawlenty, MMB, and some of us in the legislature then took a look at the guidelines, and that's when we went to the 3.5%. But that, by the way, that's not the only guideline either. We could have a discussion about what the other guidelines are as well. But I do have concerns about the bill and putting it into statute, quite frankly, and I don't know if Ms. Kelly wants to add to how well the guidelines have worked or not, but I would appreciate hearing if she has some thoughts.
Ms. Kelly.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I believe that in 2008-2009 timeframe, we were bumping up against the 3% cap, but I would have to go back and look for sure. Since that time, when we adopted new guidelines, we have been under those guidelines since they were adopted.
And Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear, when you said we were bumping up against the 3% guideline, I guess my comment was, or my question was, that we didn't go over the 3%. We followed the guideline. When you say bumping up, did we go over it, or were we close to it and under it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I'd have to go back and look to see whether we had or added or just above it.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
And Representative Carlson, there is
the
a
point,
graph.
The point, main point I want to make, Mr. Yeah. Chairman, right. is that we watched those guidelines very carefully.
Yeah. And I would just draw your attention, as well as the other members, to a graph that was prepared that's in your packet that does describe some of the fluctuations in terms of the debt for general obligation as well as general fund debt as a percent. I think Mr. Lee put that together, so that's in your packet. Any other questions for either the author of the bill or Ms. Kelly? Representative Torkelson.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. You know, it just seems that we are often willing to regulate other folks and their behavior, but when we look at regulating ourselves, we get really nervous.
Representative Vogel, you have the final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I appreciate the conversation as to whether it should be a guideline or a statute. I continue to believe that at this point we need it in statute because, it's like I said, it's gotten so large and sought a hand. In the past, too, we've had the guideline. And then when we bumped up against the guideline or found that there was a recession or some other need, we got rid of the guideline. And that's kind of led us to some extent to where we are right now. So I would ask for approval on this because I really think that it's the prudent thing to do going forward for state government so that we don't get ourselves into such a payment deficit box that all of a sudden we're looking at $2 or maybe even $2.5 billion rather than what we already have starting off every biennium with. So I thank the committee for their attention and questions, and with that, Mr. Chair, I conclude my remarks.
Members, with that, I'll renew my motion to refer House File 2970 as amended to the General Register. All those in favor? Motion by signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes.
Thank you.
Chair Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that House File 2380 be referred to the General Register.
Chair Davids moves House File 2380 before the committee and makes a motion to refer it to the General Register. Through your bill.
Thank you. And I do believe there is an amendment.
Would you like to take that up first, Chair?
Yeah. Please.
Chair Davids actually moves House the A4 to the amendment, Chair Davids.
Yes, what this does is it just it's not even my amendment, but I like it. Maybe the author of the amendment could talk to it.
Chair Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. What this does is this treats MNsure, it removes the governmental protections from MNsure from lawsuits that we provide for agencies and for units of government. I didn't really know that MNsure had this protection until Representative Gunther's constituent, who went through a horrible experience with Minsher, actually brought it to my attention that they're immune from lawsuit in a way that provides protection from that the that agencies currently have. What this does is this would put them on the same playing field as other insurance companies and other entities for people who are harmed, or indeed groups of people who are harmed, like the folks who aren't receiving their notices and like groups of folks who are being harmed by Minsure. So that's all this does. And the only reason that I did not bring this forward earlier, and I would have had I known that, is I discovered that this existed after the deadline. So that's why I'm bringing it forward here. I don't like amendments in Ways and Means, and so I would prefer not to. But as I said, I only discovered this late in the game. So that's the amendment.
Discussion to the amendment. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if staff could speak to this issue about whether Minsure is indeed immune. I did take a look at this, the section that is referred to in 1.24, and it's the basically the sovereign immunity section, and the general rule under that section is that Minnesota doesn't assert sovereign immunity against lawsuits, and then there's a whole list of exceptions to that and caps that we place for various kinds of lawsuits. And so it's kind of confusing to me what is being done here on the amendment on line 1.24. And I was not under the impression that Minsure had any sort of immunity from suit. I know that there's a complaint process and that they anybody who complains and is unhappy with the resolution can then appeal to through the administrative law process. So that is certainly available. But I wonder, do we have staff here who can speak to that? Mr. Sullivan maybe would be familiar, or I know this is more of a policy matter.
Mr. Sullivan.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I am unable to answer that at this time, and my colleague who worked on the amendment and is more familiar with the background on this issue isn't present currently, but I can get some information to you as soon as possible.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think that would be very helpful, because I think that this is it looks to me like this is a big deal, this amendment. I view this, as I'm reading this, it's just another way to bleed Minsure. It basically says, you know, what the GOP majority is doing this year is, as I said before in this committee, finding lots and lots of ways to kill Minsure and say, we really mean it, we really mean it. And what this amendment does is it invites members of the public to also throw rocks at Minsure, you know, and try to strike a knockout blow. So I think we need to know what the law really is before we start adding on additional ways for members of the public to go after Minsure, because my understanding is that there are already plenty of remedies available. And I think also it would be, let's leave it at that. I mean, I think we need to understand what the law is before we start changing the law, and we need people here. I mean, that is probably a problem, as Chair Dean said, when you bring an amendment in Ways and Means, you probably don't have the proper staff to start looking at policy issues, and this is clearly a policy issue.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. The appeals process that you noted would remain in statute, and what that does is it says that if you apply to Minsure and you don't get on, you can go through an appeals process, and that would stay intact. What this would do is simply remove the protection that the governmental agency provides over that. If you think it doesn't apply to it now, then actually putting it in law as comfort language shouldn't do anything. And if you believe it's not hurting people, you really shouldn't care, because this just simply looks at removing any governmental protection for that agency. So I think we're probably covered on both of those issues.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'd like to ask the amendment author then, in what circumstances under current Minnesota law do we allow people to recover attorney's fees and their costs and disbursements? And so what this amendment does, it has on line, starting on line 1.7, you know, may bring a civil action, et cetera, and recover damages, costs, and disbursements, including reasonable attorney's fees and a civil penalty up to $1,000. Is that, in how many circumstances do we already do that under law, or is this something that is going to be a special situation where people can recover attorney's fees, et cetera?
Representative Dean.
That simply looks at the at the section on in Minnesota law under tort claims and removes the section that provides protection from governmental agencies, and it allows what would be the remedy for people if they were bringing suit against an insurance organization or other company, the same sorts of things that they could provide or that they could take to MNsure if they were injured or if a family member were to be injured. And that's what the amendment is doing.
Representative Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't think that's correct, and that's why we need staff to tell us, because, you know, if that was true, if removing this this section of law that Representative Dean says is giving MNsure some kind of immunity, if we were just removing that, we wouldn't need this other language in the amendment that talks about allowing suits and including damages, cost disbursements, attorney's fees, and a civil penalty. I don't know why we would be needing that special language then, because if that's just what you get when you can sue some company and it's just trying to make it the same, you wouldn't need to spell that out in particular. So, I mean, I don't know if it actually, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't know if it's really, if members are really interested in the facts, then we should get the facts before we vote on this amendment, but I suspect that's not actually the case, and that it's really just offered as another way to say, look how we're getting after MNsure, look how we're hurting MNsure, look how we're, you know, giving another poke at MNsure. And if that's the case, then I guess members already know which way they're voting, and maybe it doesn't even matter if we know the facts.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this amendment lifts the damage caps. It doesn't necessarily take anything away about total immunity. It just looks at the protections that we as a government provide for ourselves that we don't offer to private industry. And we do treat MNsure very, very differently. We don't appropriate their money. They appropriate money themselves, and in fact now they're appropriating themselves more money because they're running out of it. They do not behave like an agency. They behave like an entity unto themselves, and I think they should be treated as such. And they are also hurting people. This isn't about hurting MNsure. This is about Minnesotans who have, honest to God, been hurt by it and should have remedies that are available to them because MNsure is, has, and will continue to hurt people as long as we continue to look the other way.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask, you know, it's, this is a major policy provision, interesting enough, offered by the chair of at least one of the relevant policy committees. And, you know, it's one thing if we have amendments in this committee that perhaps we're picking up bills that were heard in other committees, or at least the issue was heard, and I'm left with the impression of the discussion here that this was never heard in an appropriate policy committee. And it does put us in a rather unique role then if we're going to become both finance and policy, especially with bills that have never been heard. And while I have the floor, Mr. Chairman, I understand that 2380 in and of itself never went to the, it looks like, all of the appropriate committees necessarily, but especially this amendment here. What direction are we going in, Mr. Chairman? And I recognize you're not the permanent chair,
the motion
it raises an interesting question as to what the committee's role is going to be moving forward for the rest of the session.
Representative Carlson, House File 2380 was adopted as part of the omnibus bill that already came through this committee.
I'm aware of that.
And so,
that raises another interesting question.
So, in that function, it's being referred to the general register. I think that in light of the content of what Representative Dean's motion or his amendment provides, it's a monetary function because it lifts a monetary damage estimate on there. And so, I think it does contain in its content the purview of Ways and Means. So, with that, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a bit confused by Representative Carlson's comment about not having proper committees. Day one, I mean, I love this bill, and I will take this to any committee you want me to go to. I'll go to the Soybean Subcommittee. I'll go anywhere you want with this. But I think it has followed the that'd be your committee? Okay. But I think they've gone through the proper channels. So I think it's pretty clear that this is a commerce issue. They regulate insurance. And then we went to the Committee on Taxes, because we're talking about taxes, and now we're at Ways and Means. So I think it's appropriate. But I'd be happy to go anywhere. I'd love talking about this.
Representative Dean.
2380 was heard as an amendment in the HHS Finance Committee. So we have also heard that as well. So I think it has kind of made the rounds and seen the appropriate committees.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think it did go to HHS Finance, and if it did, and I don't even recall it being there as an amendment, frankly. I could be wrong about that, certainly. You know, members go in and out sometimes and miss amendments, but I don't remember there being a discussion. Of course, HHS Finance has jurisdiction over the MNSHR budget, so it certainly should have gone there. And if there was going to be any kind of amendment, certainly a substantive amendment, it should have been discussed in that committee. So, I mean, I think this is problematic, but there's been a lot of problematic procedure this session. And of course, you know, the ultimate thing is whether you hold a majority. But I just would remind members that if you were on the other side of this, you would probably really be squawking because, but again, you know, this is not going to go anywhere. The governor is not going to sign it. The Senate is not going to pass it. It's just here because I believe that, you know, members want to, again, show how anti-MNSHR they are. And, you know, I don't know how many times we have to do that and spend time doing it and find creative ways to do it. So it probably doesn't matter really what the procedure is. If members are going to vote for this, they're going to vote for it. But I certainly would like to get a roll call on the amendment.
Roll call being requested. I have Dean, Carlson, Davids, and Mahoney. Representative Davids, your response?
Well, yes, I think my good friend from Rochester, Representative Liebling, is going very, very, or she's crossed the line as far as questioning members' intentions on this. I think that's extremely inappropriate. And this committee and should cease immediately.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, when I referenced 2380, I did point out it went to some other committees, but not necessarily all the relevant committees is what I said, just to correct the record on that. But I said the main issue was the amendment in and of itself. I don't think that has ever been heard in any relevant committee other than just being introduced here today, and perhaps the maker of the amendment can correct me if I'm wrong on that, but that's why I raised the question. And you can argue that, okay, you can say there is some fiscal ramifications, therefore it's relevant for this committee, but the fact of the matter is that there is policy in here that has never been heard in a policy committee, as I understand it.
Representative Mahoney.
I thank Mr. Chair and to Representative Liebling's comment and Representative David's comment. You know, I really think we should hear these type bills. We've heard a number of bills that aren't going to be heard in the Senate and aren't going to be signed by the governor, and I think we really should waste another hour and a half of our lives listening to bills that really have no opportunity or any chance to be signed into law. I think it's a good waste of my time.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Do you have anything else to do?
I got magazines to read, I got candy to eat, and water to drink.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, there's one very relevant factor about this amendment. A resident from Jackson, Minnesota, one of my constituents, after they were assured they had a Minshew number and went to Rochester multiple times, found out once they got to Rochester that, oops, they made a mistake in their computer again, and she didn't have a number. So they brought her back home. And finally, out of desperation, they took her to the emergency ward and they sucked out a liter and a half of fluids from around her heart and her lungs. And I think that's very relevant because Minshew didn't have a number for her, but yet they assured the family they had one, and finally she died. And I think that's the ultimate sacrifice that family made for Minshew's irresponsibility and inability to take care of what their responsibilities are. And I tell you, I don't think the people in Jackson, Minnesota favor Minshew very much at all. And I think actuaries or penalties or anything else is going to make a bit of difference for that family.
Seeing no further
discussion. Mr. Chair.
Representative Dean.
I'll withdraw the amendment.
Representative Dean withdraws the A4 amendment. Any further discussion on the House File 2380? Hearing none, Chair Davids renews his motion to refer it to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
No.
The ayes have it. It is approved. And motion is carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Hackbarth, which of the two bills before us today would you like to start with?
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd move House File 2844 to bring the bill before us.
Representative Hackbarth, and you would like to make your motion to refer this to
General
Register?
Correct. And, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment. You get the bill in the shape that I'd like.
I see the A18. Correct?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. And then I have some modifications, and Mr. Sullivan has those modifications to the amendment.
Mr. Sullivan, would you like to describe those for the committee members?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, the changes are on page 3 of the A18 amendment. In the Section 32 crow season, the date on line 3.22, the beginning of the season, would change from March 1 to March 17. It's on line 3.22. And the other changes are at the bottom of this page. There are blank amounts for the appropriations from different accounts within the Natural Resource Fund. And the amendment would fill in the blanks, but it would also eliminate the reference to the snowmobile trails and enforcement account. So there wouldn't be an allocation from that account with the amendment. So on page 3, line 33, the first blank appropriation would be replaced with the amount $900,000. So that of the $1 million on 3.28, $900,000 would come from the all-terrain vehicle account. The rest of that line after all-terrain vehicle account would be eliminated. And the beginning of 3.34, trails and enforcement account, dollar sign ellipsis, that would be eliminated as well. Deleted and replaced with $50,000, so it would read, well, actually, I'll make one more change that Representative Hackbarth is incorporating on page 3, line 35, then delete the blank appropriation and insert $50,000. So The amended language would read $900,000 is from the all-terrain vehicle account, $50,000 is from the off-highway motorcycle account, and $50,000 is from the off-road vehicle account.
So, Mr. Sullivan, are you removing is from the snowmobile trails and enforcement account, or is that included there?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair, that would be removed, deleted.
Members, any questions about the amendment? Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. I don't have a copy of the amendment.
Members, it may be in the other packet.
With the other bill?
Yes.
No, it's on the bill. Well,
you swear?
Okay.
It wasn't in this packet. At least mine wasn't. Okay.
Or some have discovered it in House File 2380's packet. No?
Yes. Yeah, I have it now. I don't know where it was, but it wasn't with the original.
You can still have it
for me. Or, no, I've got it now. Yeah.
Representative Carlson, then.
Well, that was what I was going to ask. Okay. I didn't have a copy of the amendment.
And, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah. Representative Heckler.
I think we need to vote on the amendment to the amendment.
Yes.
Well, yeah. Mr. Chairman, then I may on that one.
Before we discuss it. Representative Kahn.
What is the reason for removing the snowmobile trails and enforcement account from the distribution?
Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kahn, I'm the one that added in the snowmobile account. I thought we could use some of their funds to help build this trail, and they're in opposition to that, so I agreed to take them out.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Is this trail is going to be used by snowmobiles also?
Representative Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, it is already part of a snowmobile system, yes.
So,
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if we need extra funding, why wouldn't some of it come from that?
Chair Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is going to be new to these other accounts. That's why these other accounts are going to be contributing.
But
it's already a snowmobile trail system, and now it's going to be ATVs, off-road trucks, and off-road motorcycles as well with this amendment.
Representative Kahn.
That means that the snowmobile system is already paying for this trail?
Chair Hackbarth.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, the snowmobile trail system is already in place.
Okay.
Hearing no further discussion, all in favor of adopting? I'm sorry, Representative Carlson.
Now, this is the amendment to the amendment, and I did dig out of my file from this afternoon the amendment that was posted, which was the one that was just handed out again. But now, the amendment to the amendment was never posted, those amounts. And if you'd care to comment on that, there was one that went the other day that hadn't been posted as well. I pointed that one out. It was a minor one. But I did ask the chair, Representative Knobloch, if the 24-hour rule was going to be hard and fast, and he basically said yes, unless he announced it in advance. Now, I don't know that this one was announced in advance. And the main reason I raise this question is that there may be times when the minority might, at the last minute, want to have some amendments that we would like to put up, and I want to make sure that they're not ruled out of order because of the 24-hour rule. And I hate to sound like I'm keeping book on you, but at least this is the second time now that majority has offered amendments that were not, to my knowledge, posted within the 24-hour rule. Now, I'm fine with your going ahead and putting the amounts in, but I just want to make sure that if we have a like situation, that we will be fairly treated.
I think Mr. Stone has a follow-on comment for that.
Representative Carlson and members of the committee, when the chair announced the committee rules, and as the committee rules are written, they specifically say the 24-hour rule does not apply to amendments to amendments. It would be almost impossible to apply the 24-hour rule to amendments if an amendment comes in at that time, you know, right. So if you look on our website and you look at the rules that were emailed to all the members of the House, et cetera. So,
now, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stone, thank you for the reminder then. I just want to make sure that that's clear then. And it's, if it's posted, then we'll proceed. Like I say, I wasn't protesting the amendment per se.
Any further conversation? Comments? Members, then, all in favor of adopting the amendment to the A18 amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment to the amendment is adopted. Chair Hackbarth, to your amended amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a few other issues that, as this bill's been working through the process, in on the very front of the amendment, it talks about the gross over limits issue. It is already in the bill, but with Representative Cornish and the DNR and some other folks in that other sportsmen's groups, we came to some agreement on this gross over limit language, and that's what is contained within this amendment. We also have a couple other provisions in here for the ATV Prospector's Loop ATV trail is what we amended in here, and hopefully we can work through the process and get that done. We're asking for some money in the bonding bill as well to help get this trail done for the Iron Range. I think that's pretty much the amendment, Mr. Chairman. Oh, I should mention, too, that the deer hunting survey money is in this amendment as well on page 3, on line 7, beginning on line 17. So there were a request to come up with some money for the deer hunting survey, so that's what this does.
Discussion to the A18 amendment as amended. Representative Kahn.
I'm interested in the section on page 2, 2-1 to 2-8. Why is it it looks like we're easing up for a while for an animal that's threatened or endangered. Why would that be?
Sure, Hackbarth.
Well, maybe I'll bring the DNR down and they can explain this. This is a part of their language that they requested in this bill for the gross over limits language that Governor Dayton wanted to have.
Welcome to the committee. If you could just
Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Kahn. The language on 2.6, the new language on 2.6 to 2.8, is to clarify that if a person unintentionally captures an endangered or threatened wild animal, that they would not be immediately in violation of this gross over limits bill. Some of the restitution values are over $1,000. That is the new threshold that we're looking at. So, for example, if you were trapping and you unintentionally captured a lynx and you reported it, did everything legally to follow the law, you would not be found in violation of a gross misdemeanor or fall into its gross violations where you lose. Now you're losing your hunting and fishing privileges for 10 years rather than five, and actually when you do lose them, it's throughout the entire state, the entire country, basically. Most of the other states, I believe all the other states are under a compact where if you are found in violation of one state's code or fishing and game, you lose your hunting or fishing privileges. In Minnesota, for example, you are not able to hunt or fish in any other state in the country until that's corrected.
Representative Kahn.
Would someone explain how the more than one animal is computed? Is that in a season, in a lifetime, in a
Mr.
in
Chair,
a day?
Mr.
Representative Kahn, it would be for that violation. So if you were trapping and you caught one, then at that point in time, it's not a cumulative impact. So every time you go out, you could be found in violation of something again. So it's per instance.
So you could trap
Representative
a lynx,
Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, you could trap a lynx a day and it would be okay.
Mr.
Chair, Representative Kahn, we would be working with that individual upon that first one and there would be other intentions that would follow after that.
What?
Representative Kahn.
How does one see that from this law?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, we need to go into the rest of the statute to actually find those sections. I don't have the statute book in front of me right now.
Well.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Kahn?
It just seems completely I don't like to see things written into law that look so totally unclear and ununderstandable.
I'm sure that Mr. Meyer would be happy to work with you offline to explain that section of the code.
Mr. Chair, members, we will follow. I'll provide additional information to the committee, and so everybody will have that.
Excuse me, we're being asked to vote on it now.
I understand.
Not.
Did you have a follow-up?
Not really. I just don't.
Representative Liebling.
It seems very unclear to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, I don't usually get involved with this area of the legislation because I'm not familiar with it. But just looking at it from the point of view of drafting, it does seem to me that it might not actually be drafted to do what the testifier was talking about. I mean, if the intention is to not go after somebody for what amounts to an unintentional taking, then maybe, I don't know if you can draft these kinds of laws in this area to actually say that. I mean, don't you need some kind of intent element or not a criminal statute if you can put some burden on the person to come forward and, you know, I mean, there just should be another way to draft this that would make the intention clearer. And, you know, I don't know if we're in a position to fix that right now, but maybe you could just comment on whether it could be more clearly drafted to express what the department is actually trying to do here. So I think Representative Kahn is absolutely right. I mean, just reading this as legislative language, it is very unclear.
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, we can certainly look at that as this bill progresses from here to the floor. I don't have any suggestions right now. As we've discussed this in many committees and in the other body, people weren't expressing that concern, but I will bring that back to our legal counsel and see if we can come up with some more clearer language to address that concern.
So,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, you mean I'm not the first person who has asked? Other people have asked about it before, and it still isn't an answer for it?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, I meant to say that the question hasn't come up. People thought the language was clear enough as it progressed. This bill is actually on the floor of the other body, and it's gone through judiciary and other committees with this language.
Follow-up, Representative Liebling? I'm sorry. Representative Kahn.
Did anyone read it? That's not a question that needs to be answered.
Representative Cornish.
I was just going to say it went through our committee. It was well discussed by everybody. Everybody understood it and approved it, and this is a Ways and Means Committee and not the Policy Committee, and it's already gone through that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Then, Representative Cornish, are you prepared to say if it's perfectly all right for someone in this section to go out and trap a lynx or a wolf a day without any penalties?
No.
Representative Cornish.
Not what it says.
That is the explanation that we got. I asked, Mr. Chairman, I asked for an explanation, and that was the explanation. It was only this one incident.
So, I didn't receive that from the explanation at all.
What?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, this language, the intent of this language as it's drafted would be to provide so that a person, if they accidentally capture or take an endangered or threatened wild animal that exceeds the penalties that you'll see the restitution values. Lines 2.22, we're reducing the restitution value from $5,000 to $1,000. If you exceed that accidentally, we do not want to make that person a criminal and take away their hunting and fishing privileges for a period of 5 or 10 years. So that was the intent of the language, and I believe it does work, but we will work with the author and members to try to clarify that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
Why doesn't it just say that? If a person acts, it's not what it says.
Mr. Meyer, I have a question for you. How often does a trapper accidentally come across a trap that would have trapped a lynx?
Mr. Chairman, members, it's very rare. It's not that. Trappers are very knowledgeable about how they're setting their sets and what they're doing, and they're making sure that they're doing everything they can to not do that. And so, but accidents do occur. So,
would it be fair to say that if you come across a trapper who has the proclivity for finding endangered animals in their traps probably more than once a year, that you've got a problem with that trapper that you're going to address directly with that trapper?
Mr. Chairman, members, yes, there would be other venues that we would be following. other enforcement opportunities would present itself in that case.
Mr. Chairman, that's not what the language in front of me says, so sorry if I'm being picky.
I have Representative McNamara on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Meyer, if I remember this issue right, and I actually support this language, I think it's really important because there's no other way to write it. As rare as it is, you could accidentally trap one of these threatened or endangered wild animals. Very rare to have happen, but the unintended consequence, we have that in law, that if you happen to do that, as slim as the possibility is, there's a reporting mechanism for you to abide by the law, call your local CO, and I can't remember exactly how it works, but sometimes you have to call them before you begin to transport it, and those kind of things. And it wouldn't be fair that that person then would lose their hunting, trapping, and fishing privileges across the nation for a long time. And that's why it's in here. And there's no other way of doing it. You have to allow, I get that it, Representative Kahn's point is this might let somebody off the hook that we'd like to get. But I'm sorry, there's unintended consequences that we have to realize could happen here, and it would not be fair to let that happen. So I appreciate you in this language, and it is the right thing to have it in here. We have to have that opportunity for people to not get found guilty of something that you can. Is the best trapper in the world could accidentally, even though it's not a Lynx Pro trap set, a lynx for some way somehow was chasing a rabbit in a certain direction and happened to stumble upon it. So I think it's the right language to save somebody from getting a really bad consequence. Thank you.
Members, any further discussion before we move to adopt the A18 as amended? Hearing none, all those in favor of adopting the A18 as amended signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No. No.
Motion prevails. Representative Hagbarth, to your House File 2844 as amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. There's a number of physical issues in the bill that have to do with removing the turkey stamp, the new off-road truck issue, where we're going to be issuing a new different license for people to off-road truck. A number of other issues, the wolf management account, we're eliminating the wolf management account and moving that money and using that money for the deer hunting survey. There's a couple of other minor things for rulemaking, etc. Part of the money from the general fund is for, I think, the Northern Pike rulemaking. So those are some of the issues that are in the bill as relatively minor fiscal costs.
Discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Carlson.
Yeah, the comment, minor fiscal cost, it's my understanding that there's almost a couple hundred thousand in tails again in this bill. And it, I just want to point that out. I think it, the actual number is like 196,000. I don't know if Mr. Marks is prepared to let us know where we are with tails right now, but I think at some point it would be interesting to know the accumulation of tails and what those numbers are. They're not part of the budget resolution, but it's something we try to keep an eye on.
Mr. Marks, any comments?
Mr. Chair, members, this bill with the amendments has no general fund cost. This is a the amendment, most of the general fund cost was relative to a deer survey. The language in the bill or in the amendment said that that now has to be covered by game and fish fund appropriations, and it makes no appropriation from the general fund. So the general fund cost of this bill in fiscal 17 or in 18 and 19 would be tracked to zero. As to the bigger question of where tails are at, it's given the bills that have passed the House or out of Ways and Means, it's at approximately $9 million, negative $9 million at this point.
Okay. So the amendment took care of the 196. That's okay. But overall, then, we're at about $9
million. Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, negative $9
million. Negative $9 million. Okay.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hackbarth, do I assume that the wolf management and monitoring will continue to be done, but it won't have a separate account?
Chair Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The money that is already in the wolf management account, we don't touch that. We leave that in place in case it ever comes off the endangered list again. At the federal level, as you might know, the wolf is now protected again. We're not doing any hunting or trapping of the wolf. So right now there is no wolf management in the state of Minnesota because of what the federal courts have done. There is no wolf management. So that's just kind of stable. We're keeping that in place. We're keeping the money in that account. But the 50 cents that was on the deer hunting license is now going directly into the Game and Fish Fund.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Representative Hackbarth, I'm looking at Section 25 on page 14. So how many guys do you think will follow your lead and start wearing blaze pink?
Chair Hackbarth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Wagenius. I hope a lot, and if this law passes and does become law, I will be one of them. Because deer can't see blaze pink as well as they can see blaze orange, because blaze orange has a blue hue in it, and they can see that easier than they can see blaze pink. So if this law does become, or if this bill does become law, I will be wearing blaze pink in the woods. It'll be easier for me to get a deer.
Representative Wagenius.
Will you send pictures?
Absolutely.
Representative Kahn.
The question was answered about the wolf management account.
For the comments, for the author. You have the final word, Representative Hackbarth.
Thank you for your time, members. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Members, Representative Hackbarth renews his motion to refer House File number 2844 as amended to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion prevails. Chair Hackbarth, you have another one up on the docket today.
Mr. Chairman, I would move House File 3925 to bring the bill before us, and I would recommend that we send it to the General Register.
Members, I see no amendments. Is that correct, Chair Hackbarth?
No amendments from me, Mr. Chairman. No author's amendments.
Discussion to the bill.
Members, this is the IRRRB reform bill. I think the according to the fiscal note, it's we're dealing with $575,000. This is the issue that we're going to look at before this committee. This has to do with not general fund money, but money that would come from the IRRRB to set up this new commission, and it would replace the IRRRB board with the new commission, and approximately $400,000 of this money would be for hiring a new director and some staff to run this new commission. And it also has about $175,000 in it to look at the study the possible sale of the Giants Ridge. And that's pretty much the amount of or what the money is all about in this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Discussion from the committee. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's very important that we had a review by the legislative auditor of the IRRRB, because many people across the state and state legislators were wondering what was going on. And the legislative auditor report came out, and there are recommendations. And those recommendations have been answered by the commissioner and members of the IRRB. Nobody's acknowledging that there doesn't have to be changes to be made. But to change the total makeup of something that is understood and is part of the people in the IRRB district without a lot more input than what we've received and what the model that was used for House File 3925 is an injustice to the wonderful things that have happened in the years that the IRRB has existed. It is the economic engine of the Iron Range in that the property taxes that are not paid by the companies are distributed by the IRRB. When the makeup of the Iron Range Resources Board has their own representatives on that board, the people have confidence that they are being heard. When they can go to the grocery store and bump into a representative of the IRRB board, that makes a difference. It's like each one of us in our districts. I have constituents that are part of the district, of the board. I am not on at this time, but I have been on the IRRB board. I know how the decisions are made. Open, transparently, with the room packed with constituents there from all the governments and school districts. The Iron Range Resources Board meetings are as important as the local school district board meetings are, and as the city council meetings are, and the town board meetings are. People understand it. People know when the vote's coming up. People know when their grants have to be submitted. They know who to call if they need help to make the grant work. The staff will come out to the neighborhoods or to the area and provide help before the decisions are made. And much of that is just a vision with the model that's contained in 3925. It's too drastic. The model is too drastic. The approval, in my mind, is fine. The constitutionality can be answered. But the immediacy of the people to have a say and know who's making the say and know the people who's making the say and who to talk to is very important, and it's the core of the democracy of the decision making that's taken place. I recommend a no.
Further discussion on the bill. Hearing none, Chair Hackbarth, you have the final word.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I do want to clarify that the new commission will have three citizen members on there, on the new commission, all, and it states that they all have to be from the Iron Range.
Hearing no further discussion, Chair Hackbarth renews his motion to re-refer House File 3925 to the General Register. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Nice job.
No. Members, some housecleaning before we adjourn. Expectation is that we will meet at our regularly scheduled meeting on Monday at 10:15. And then on Tuesday, we have a joint meeting with the Senate. With that, members, we are adjourned.